Iran Islam says outrageous the U.S. denial of an agreed deal on a humanitarian prisoner's swap, saying Tehran is ready to proceed. Turkey says a top European Union court's ruling in hijab would worsen prejudice against Muslim women in Europe. Concerns are growing ahead of the start of Tokyo Olympics as the organizers report three new COVID-19 infections among athletes. Great pleasure to have you with us. Now let's start with our top story this hour. Iranian foreign ministry hitting back at the United States after it denied an agreement, also involving the UK, to swap 10 prisoners on all sides. Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh stressed that existence of the deal and even an agreement on how to announce it are simple facts. He said that the U.S. denying the matter is outrageous. Khatibzadeh said that the humanitarian swap was agreed in Vienna, but separately from the nuclear negotiations. He said that Iran is ready to proceed today. Iran's top nuclear negotiator in Vienna talks said that the prisoner exchange could take place on Sunday, but a spokesman for the U.S. State Department denied any deal outside the framework of the nuclear talks. Ned Price claimed that a prisoner swap is held up by the delay in the nuclear negotiations. He also accused Iran of an outrageous effort to deflect blame for the impasse in the negotiations. Okay, now time now for the news review section. Now, representatives of the Afghan government and the Taliban are due to meet in the Qatari capital, Doha, for a second day of talks. Several ranking officials, including former President Hamid Karzai and head of the High Council for National Reconciliation, Abdullah Abdullah, are attending the negotiations. The new round of talks is a stirred hopes that might lead to lasting peace in the country. For months, the two sides have been meeting on and off in Doha without any major breakthrough. The negotiations come as the Taliban have stepped up attacks on cities and villages, seizing a vast part of territory. The Taliban's supreme leader, Hibatullah Akhundzada, now saying that he strenuously favors political settlement in spite of the group's territorial gains and advances. Our own correspondent, Kabul Amin Alami, joining us. Amin, bring us an update on what the situation is like, what the Taliban is saying now. They are fighting, they are capturing land, government is taking it back, and then they are at the same time in Doha talking peace. What's going on?
Well, let's start from security situation in Afghanistan. The security situation seems to be too fragile because government forces are resisting in many fronts against the Taliban militants who are launching heavy-scale attacks mainly on district centers and some of key areas, especially in border points of Afghanistan, in some parts of northern Afghanistan, southern and western parts of this country. However, the people, rural people here in Afghanistan, as well as many politicians, are optimistic about the positive outcome of the ongoing peace negotiations between the Afghan government and the Taliban negotiating teams in the Qatari capital, Doha. In the meantime, the attendees of this meeting, Doha summit, or the intra-Afghan talks, also say that they are optimistic to reach an agreement at the end of this negotiations to lead the country into a lasting peace and stability. However, the facts on the ground currently shows that both sides are engaging heavy fightings and heavy battles across Afghanistan, and dozens of them are being killed on a daily basis. As official figures show, over 120 Taliban militants were killed over the past 24 hours as a result of military operations conducted by Afghan security forces. While the Taliban also claims that The militants of the group have killed dozens of Afghan security forces during their attacks on some areas in northern Faryab province of Afghanistan and western Ghor province, and also in southern Ghazni province. However, the ongoing peace negotiations in the Qatari capital, Doha, is set to be very important for the future of Afghanistan, for the fate of the people of Afghanistan, and lots of people, not only rural people here, but also, for instance, media activists, politicians, and even cultural activists believe that the only way to lead Afghanistan and its people to calm, peace and stability is to convince both sides to agree on silencing the guns.
Thank you very much for that. Amin Alami, our correspondent, joined me from Kabul. Now moving on, the annual Hajj pilgrimage has started in Mecca, with tens of thousands of Muslims residing in Saudi Arabia amid the coronavirus pandemic. Authorities have chosen only 60,000 fully vaccinated residents through a lottery to take part in the second downsized Hajj pilgrimage. The number is far below for one of the world's largest annual religious gatherings, which saw some 2.5 million attending the ceremony before the pandemic in 2019. Pictures out of the Grand Mosque in Mecca show pilgrims circling Islam's holiest site in masks and on distanced paths. The five-day Hajj reaches its peak on Tuesday, which marks Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice. The repercussions of the Saudi-led war in Yemen are getting worse year after year. Thousands of disabled in the war-torn country are deprived of their basic rights, such as access to medical assistance, amid the apathy of international bodies. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, has a report.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led war on Yemen, thousands of civilians have lost their limbs, eyes, or got mentally disabled due to the lethal bombardment on civilian facilities. According to the Amnesty International, 4 million people with disabilities in Yemen face multiple challenges, and the number is growing up each year as the war continues.
We feel like there is deliberate negligence by the international organizations towards us, as they have not provided anything so far. This comes as the number of disabled exceeds 4 million, according to the UN organizations. We call on the international organizations to come and see our sufferings. Most of us don't even have a wheelchair.
Yemen's Disabled Care Fund says it provides healthcare services for more than 200,000 disabled, including 50,000 children who are getting educational services as well. However, the fund is suffering from a shortage of money amid the continued absence of related international organizations.
The Disabled Care Fund suffers from many difficulties, including lack of resources. Meanwhile, there is a significant increase in the number of the disabled each year. Sometimes we cannot provide wheelchairs and medicines for some of the disabled. Unfortunately, the international organizations turned a blind eye to this humanitarian catastrophe. We call on all the related international bodies to fulfill their duty towards the disabled Yemenis and provide aid to this vulnerable group.
In late 2015, the Saudi-led coalition has bombed the Anour Center for Care and Rehabilitation of the Blind in Sana'a, inflicting heavy damages on it. Since the beginning of the Saudi war on Yemen in March 2015, the relentless bombardments of the kingdom have killed tens of thousands of civilians, including women and the children.
Besides losing parts of their bodies, millions of people with disabilities are among those most oppressed groups amid what the United Nations has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. They say the Saudi war and the blockade have turned their lives into a real tragedy. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Now, Turkey has condemned the ruling by the top European Union court allowing companies to ban employees wearing headscarves under certain conditions. Ankara slammed the verdict as a clear violation of religious freedoms, adding that the move would exacerbate prejudice against Muslim women in Europe. The Turkish Foreign Ministry said that the ruling was a sign of rising Islamophobia at a time when Muslim women in Europe are being subjected to increasing discrimination for their religious beliefs. Luxembourg-based EU Court of Justice ruled on Thursday that employers may ban the wearing of visible symbols of religious or political belief, such as headscarves. It added, however, in its ruling that respective courts in the bloc's 27 member states should consider whether the ban corresponds to a genuine need on the part of the employers.
Shock has rippled through the Muslim community after the European Union's highest court ruled that businesses can sack Muslim women for wearing the hijab if they work face-to-face with customers or if the wearing of the religious clothing causes workspace conflicts. The ruling was in response to a case brought by two German Muslim female workers who were asked by their employers not to wear Islamic headscarves while at work.
The decision has been met by claims that it will further fuel Islamophobia at this crucial time when countries in Europe such as France and Austria are already eliminating freedoms for Muslims, supposedly to combat extremism.
In Britain, several religious MPs, including Muslims and a Sikh, chastised the court, labelling the ruling as Islamophobic and deeply flawed. In addition, I spoke with a London-based female Muslim media personality about her fears for the future of Muslims in Europe.
To me, I feel oppressed, to be honest, by this decision. And I feel that I am now limited in my identity and my freedom of rights, freedom of belief, all the values that are actually supposedly meant to be Western, modern. Yes, part of it is a symbol of my faith, but it's so much more if you were to really understand what the hijab actually means or any sort of religious symbol. It is not just coming from one aspect. I think it's really unfair. And it's, again, it is targeting a particular group, especially the Muslim women, because we are the ones that are known to be wearing the headscarf known as the hijab.
Many activists warned that following the niqab ban, European powers would target the hijab next. They were right. But if the battle to protect the hijab is lost, what comes next? Robert Carter, London.
Rescue workers are still searching for survivors in parts of northwestern Europe after rain-triggered floods caused rivers to burst and houses to collapse. Days of extreme rainfall in Germany and Belgium have claimed the lives of 183 people, with many still missing. The death toll could rise further. In many areas, rescue efforts have been called off. The focus has shifted to the cleaning operation. The scale of the damage is becoming clear as the waters begin to recede and crews clear the streets of debris. Efforts are also being made to restore gas, electricity, and telephone lines. European leaders have blamed climate change for the worst floods in decades. Switzerland, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands have also been affected. And COVID-19 cases surge in several EU nations have been mainly attributed to the highly contagious Delta variant. And that could have major health and economic implications. Jerome Hughes has more.
Following an easing of restrictions in the EU and UK, coronavirus cases across Western Europe are on a sharp upward curve. The Delta variant, first identified in India and which spreads much more easily, is being blamed.
The world is becoming a village, so people travel, it's hard to contain.
See all the people here? And some people are not that careful, I think, so...
One word for me, go to vaccine.
The vast majority of young adults and children in the EU have not been vaccinated. This is why the virus is moving around so quickly, experts say.
In view of the rapid spread of the highly contagious Delta variant that is raising concerns not only in Europe but also around the globe, it is extremely important to vaccinate as per national recommendations as many people in Europe as possible.
Economists say the EU simply cannot afford further lockdowns. Economic forecasts for the 27-nation bloc are positive, but there are a lot of unknowns.
We continue to monitor the situation very closely, and in particular, and obviously, we are monitoring the Delta variant.
The fact that protectionist Donald Trump is no longer in the White House offers some economic hope, senior EU officials are indicating.
In terms of our relationships with the US, we have gone from a winter of discontents to a summer of cooperation.
In several EU nations, including Greece, France and Ireland, young people have staged protests believing they are being forced by governments to take the jab in order to participate in society. We have been getting some views in Belgium.
I mean, it's good that the protest is there, isn't it?
I feel forced to receive something I don't want to receive.
Be vaccinated or not, so you can't force people to do that.
Health authorities in the EU argue it is important that young people do get vaccinated, claiming they may only develop a mild illness initially with COVID-19, but could ultimately go on to suffer from long COVID, which can have life-changing implications. Campaigners say EU leaders are shooting themselves in the foot by not providing more vaccines to less well-off parts of the world. This could lead to new variants that might be resistant to existing vaccines, they warn. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Concerns are also growing as the number of COVID-19 infections among Tokyo Olympics athletes is on the rise. Organizers of the Games reported 3 new cases on Sunday. There were also 10 new cases connected to Olympics, including media, contractors, and other personnel. An International Olympic Committee member who had been inoculated tested positive upon landing in Tokyo, and this indicates the high infection risk even from vaccinated attendees. Infection rates are climbing among the general population of the capital, topping 1,000 new cases for 4 consecutive days. Polls indicating that many Japanese oppose holding the games with the influx of overseas visitors that it entails. A shooting outside a baseball stadium in the U.S. capital, Washington, D.C., has left at least 4 people wounded. It happened while a game was going on at Nationals Park that was packed with thousands of spectators. The incident caused the match to be abruptly halted, and players rushed off the field. Some fans scrambled for the exits after hearing the gunshots before all the crowd were told to leave. Police said that the victims were taken to hospitals for treatment and that there was no ongoing threat. No immediate words about the shooters yet. And that's all we have for you for this news broadcast. So from Tehran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
June 28, 2021, on the occasion of the National Judiciary Week and the martyrdom anniversary of Ayatollah Martyr Beheshti and other personalities. There is so much in the field of production that one cannot understand until one has contacted and heard from the people who are active in the issues of production, such as officials in charge of labor issues and laborers themselves. Communication with these active groups is part of popular presence and public communication, and therefore we must pay attention to it. The first benefit of it is that you can hear from them what the main problems are, and secondly, you can explain things to them. It is often the case that organizations have certain policies, some of which are protested against from the outside. They have no bad intention, but they protest because they do not have enough information. In other words, they do not know the reasoning for this decision. So because they do not know, they protest. All right, you could explain it to them. There are some things that need to be explained and clarified. Well, these statements were about the judiciary. By God's favor, a new chapter will begin in the judiciary's branch. And God willing, the same approach and method that was very good in the time of Mr. Raisi in the past 2+ years will continue with its strength, so that there will be even more achievements and more dynamism. A strong blow to those trying to create a boycott of the elections. I would also like to say a few things about the elections. This election was truly magnificent. This election that took place was literally an epic created by the people. Well, efforts were being made. They were writing in cyberspace, they are talking in media in order to deny the greatness of this election, but it is of no use. This effort is in vain. It was a big achievement. The analysts who cast their eyes on the elections understand what happened. Where in the world is it common for all opposing propaganda apparatuses, the active and influential ones, to do their utmost to intimidate people with the purpose of discouraging them from participating in the elections? American and English media, as well as the media in some reactionary and notorious countries, focused all their efforts on our elections. Their own agents, coupled with some treacherous Iranian individuals who are living under the flag of the American and the English, and who feed for them, began to work since long ago in radio, television, and satellite channels, and in cyberspace, not just one and two of them, rather hundreds and thousands of them, in order to push the people away from the elections.
Communique. The People's Mujahideen of Iran, also known as the MEK or MKO, is a very controversial group with a controversial past. Banned in Iran and Iraq, it once stood on the United States list of terrorist organizations, worked with Saddam Hussein, helped the Israelis, and is now exiled in Albania, receiving funding from Saudi Arabia. The group's number one goal is to overthrow the Islamic Republic of Iran through violent means and install a new government. In Iran, the group has killed thousands of civilians, assassinated dozens of high-ranking government officials, and even targeted Americans and other foreigners too. They claim to stand for human rights and democracy. But are they really the democratic opposition to Iran that they market themselves as?
I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
The People's Mujahideen of Iran, also called the MEK or MKO, first started out in Iran as a political group in the 1960s, with its ideology initially rooted in Marxism, feminism, and Islamism. The group was anti-US, taking a harsh stance against Western ideology and capitalism. It opposed the Shah, the US-backed puppet ruler of Iran at the time. And the MEK was initially made up largely of students and middle-class Iranians, During the Islamic Revolution in 1979, the group did play a role in the overthrow of the Shah. However, the degree to which they helped accomplish this appears to be somewhat exaggerated by the MEK. In the first days of the Islamic Republic, the MEK suffered numerous political defeats in Iran. It opposed the country's draft constitution and boycotted its referendum in 1979, a referendum which ultimately passed and was approved by a majority of Iranians. The group was consequently not allowed to participate in the presidential elections and took a huge loss in parliamentary elections, failing to win even a single seat. After failing to gain any traction and coming out of the legislative and electoral process with no viable path forward, the MEK began threatening to take up arms against the Islamic Republic and commenced a ruthless bombing campaign across Iran. On June 28, 1981, the MEK blew up the headquarters of the Islamic Republican Party. This massive explosion killed 72 officials, including the Chief Justice and Party Secretary Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, who also played a pivotal role in the Islamic Revolution. Among the 72 martyred were four cabinet ministers, the ministers of health, transport, telecommunications, and energy, as well as 27 members of Iran's parliament, the Mejlis, and other important political and military figures in Iran. This terrorist attack is known as the Haftatir bombing. The MEK has neither denied nor confirmed responsibility, although their responsibility for the attack is commonly accepted both inside Iran and outside, as the group has publicly approved of this attack, and even the United States government itself cited this terrorist attack in a 2005 country report on Iran. 2 months later, in August 1981, the MEK bombed the offices of then Prime Minister Mohammad Jawad Bahonar. The explosion killed both the Prime Minister, the Chief of Police, and the President, Mohammad Ali Rajai. The group's violence has not just been limited to Iranians and has even targeted foreigners. By the U.S. own admission, during the 1970s, the MEK killed three U.S. Army colonels as well as three U.S. contractors. The group has also tried to assassinate the general command of the U.S. military mission and attacked numerous facilities in Iran belonging to American companies such as Pepsi, Shell Oil, Pan Am Airlines, General Motors, and more. During Saddam Hussein's violent war against Iran from 1980 to 1988, Iran was attacked by Iraq, who was supported at the time both by the Americans and the British, who had given Saddam Hussein chemical weapons. During this period, Saddam Hussein allied himself with the MEK and incorporated them into his assault against Iran, providing the group with weaponry, money, and logistical support. This proved to be yet another huge mistake on the MEK's part. Not only did their violent plans to overthrow the Iranian government fail to materialize, but the fact that they had begun working with Saddam Hussein made their reputation even worse, causing them to effectively lose all support domestically. This earned them the nickname Munafiqeen, or hypocrites. Their actions were seen as treasonous, for they had now sided with a foreign country and taken up arms with Saddam against their fellow countrymen in Iran. This would end up becoming a common theme for the MEK, for although the organization claims to be fighting for Iranians, it is in fact not based in Iran. After being exiled, the group relocated from Iran to France, from France to Iraq, and now finds itself in Albania. Knowing that it lacks any popular support at home, during the last decades, the MEK has enjoyed varying levels of support from foreign governments. This includes financial backing as well as logistical, political, and military support, not just from Saddam's Iraq, but also from other Arab countries and Western countries too. Although the MEK was once listed as a terrorist organization in the US and UK, this is no longer the case. Several US politicians, lawmakers, and military officials have participated in or attended MEK events and received thousands of dollars from the group. A Guardian investigation from 2012 shows how several key figures in the US, ranging from lawmakers, former officials, and DC lobby groups, were the recipients of large sums of money from the MEK. The MEK sought to bribe them into delisting the organization as a terror group, and these efforts ultimately proved to be successful when former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton removed the MEK from the U.S. list of terrorist groups in 2012. Since then, the cash flow has not ceased, as we've seen more recently former New York mayor and Donald Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani, as well as former National Security Advisor John Bolton, both taking money from the MEK. In present times, Saudi Arabia is widely considered to be the group's largest financial backer. And if working with Saddam Hussein wasn't enough, the MEK has also cooperated with the Israelis on numerous occasions against Iran. In recent times, the MEK fabricated claims that Tehran was pursuing a nuclear weapons program and assisted the Israelis in fabricating and disseminating false documents to that effect. Between the years 2010 and 2012, Israel is known to have carried out the assassinations of several prominent nuclear scientists in Iran. The MEK was involved in those killings and received funding, financing, and training from the Israelis. The latest assassination in late 2020 of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh is also believed to have been carried out by the Israelis, again in cooperation with the MEK. Now, with President-elect Raisi's landslide victory, the MEK has attempted to renew its efforts against Iran and rally more people around its cause. The group cites Raisi's long-term career in the judiciary as a point of contention. However, it admits recently in the press that it doesn't matter who had won the election because they are opposed to everyone. After all, the stated goal of the MEK is to overthrow the Islamic Republic in its entirety, and they deem all political movements in Iran, whether principalist or moderate or reformist, to be the same in their view. And in order to help them do that, they're willing to enlist the help of foreign governments in Europe, in America, and have been more than willing to use their help in subverting and attacking the Islamic Republic. On the weekend of July 10th, 2021, the so-called Free Iran World Summit taking place. This is a three-day online event promoting the MEK and its movement to overthrow the Islamic Republic of Iran. It's basically a get-together between MEK members and foreign politicians where they collectively bash Iran, call its elections fraudulent, which is convenient given that the MEK has never won a single seat in parliament, and repeat the usual propaganda about a nuclear weapons program that doesn't exist, and so on. Now, leading the MEK's event is the current head, Maryam Rajavi. This event includes speakers such as former Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, the former Italian Minister of Foreign Affairs, the former Prime Minister of Albania. Also speaking at the event are dozens of U.S. senators and House members from both the Democratic and Republican parties, including Senators Robert Menendez, Ted Cruz, Roy Blunt, Ben Cardin, and Congressman Kevin McCarthy and Hakeem Jeffries. Also present is General James Jones, who used to be President Obama's National Security Advisor, and several former European ministers, including the former foreign ministers of France, Italy, Poland, the former British and French defense ministers, and the leader of Europe's People's Party, the largest in Europe. What I've just read to you is straight from the event's website. As you can see, this is a long, long list of high-ranking officials, foreign dignitaries, and lawmakers from all across the Western world who clearly have no problem attending the event of a terrorist group that has literally assassinated an Iranian president, an Iranian prime minister, dozens of government officials, and taken up arms with Israel against their own countrymen in Iran. Then these Western politicians, in the same breath, have the gall to call Iran a terrorist state as they literally sit and speak with terrorists themselves. After all, are we surprised? This is no different from seeing Senator John McCain posing with Al-Qaeda fighters after illegally entering Syria, or Donald Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein, and so on and so forth. Bipartisanship for regime change is always there, and the United States and its allies literally make money from sponsoring terrorism. That's all their foreign policy is, overthrowing governments and countries they don't like so that they can steal their land and control their resources. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Now joining me to discuss more is Anne-Khoda Bande. She's an expert on the methodology of radicalization and cultic abuse and terrorism. Thank you so much for taking the time, Anne. It's a pleasure to have you on.
You're welcome.
The MEK, or the People's Mujahideen, they've moved headquarters several times in the last years. They're currently based in Albania. Could you maybe tell us a bit about that, how it came to be that they've moved headquarters several times and what they're doing in Albania right now?
Well, I'll just skip back 20 years with the invasion of Iraq. And, of course, Mujahideen were hand-in-hand with the Saddam regime. And so they had a massive base there, a military base, and they were sort of launching attacks into Iran from Iraq. That all ended, of course, in 2003. And They were corralled into one base, disarmed by the US Army, and sort of left while everybody figured out what to do with them. From there, from Camp Ashraf in the Diyali province, they went to a base just outside Baghdad with a view to actually moving them out of the country. Of course, in the meantime, Mariam Rajavi was in Paris. She came over there 30 years ago, but the main body of the organization had been stuck in Iraq for you know, three decades since the revolution. Hillary Clinton managed to persuade the Albanian government at the time, the Prime Minister was Sali Berisha, and said, you know, we'll take this organization on. So that was the deal in 2013. In 2016, they started sending people there. Mariam Rajavi continued in France. The every major city, Europe, North America, had a kind of a cell of the MEK. The people who came to Albania did so essentially without any ID documents. The UNHCR, which was actually responsible for moving them, gave each of them a document which said, I am being transferred for humanitarian reasons. And they just basically had their name, whichever name they chose to give, because a lot of them came with false names, and it's actually not known exactly who they are, although most of them are known to, you know, the intelligence services of all the countries that they're in. So they ended up as a group in Albania. Now, the reason Mariam Rajavi is now in Albania holding her meeting is because she's been expelled from Europe. That was 2018. I think things came to a head with the intelligence services. They assessed this group in their sphere, the EU, as a risk.
Right. I mean, we recall that several U.S. officials are on the payroll of the MEK, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, she removed them off the list of terrorist organizations. Does the United States have a long-term agenda at play here in supporting the MEK?
Simple answer, yes. You know, the Americans, well, I say support, and Americans' involvement with the Mujahideen goes way, way back to after they left Iran. After the revolution, they were pushed out. And it was, in fact, the French CIA who sort of brokered a deal with France to take them there, give them a base, give them some land, let them sort of establish a headquarters there. And I'm sure somewhere along the line you'll find the name Donald Rumsfeld among those deals that took place. Yeah, what a guy. And also, you know, Donald Rumsfeld basically gifted the MEK to Saddam Hussein. France was saying, well, you know, I don't want these people, what can we do? So they sent Massoud Rajavi, who was leader at the time, to Iraq. The Americans have kind of kept them at arm's length. None of the top leaders have ever been allowed into America. Mariam Rajavi was desperate to try and get in. Back in 94, 95, 96, she came back to Europe. America has refused her a visa all that time. The UK managed to kind of give her a short sort of overnight trip to have a meeting and then sent her straight back to France. And France has tolerated her because it had to. But all this time, yes, the anti-Iran American European crowd have found the Mujahideen a very useful kind of tool to amplify their agenda, to pass off information like the nuclear revelations. And you will find, yes, that they have been, I mean, people like John Bolton, although people like him are paid for meetings, and it's quite open that the Mujahideen pay these people, but very often they're quite actually, you know, they really believe that the Mujahideen are sort of an opposition group and can overthrow the regime and make a difference to the situation there. So yes, the American involvement, and it isn't just the Republicans, the Democrats, it's a bipartisan support, and it's individuals rather than government. The only government in the world after Saddam Hussein who has actually supported the Mujahideen has been Albanian government, unfortunately.
Right, and I mean, just generally speaking, what would you say is the current level of support that they enjoy from the Biden administration and other European countries or Arab countries at the moment?
In terms of the Biden administration, I sincerely hope that there's a memo gone out from the Defense Department and the Department of State to sort of say, look, you know, drop this group. Certainly, I think among the actual officials in those ministries, there's a very sort of profound understanding that this group is not, it's a toxic group and it shouldn't be supported. And the only people who do continue to support them are paid. As we'll see in the meeting today. In Europe, again, you know, the Mujahideen made themselves so impossible by constantly invading the European Parliament, harassing MEPs, lobbying, you know, left, right and centre. And it, I think it was a sense of relief when they were actually sent out of the European Union and kind of, you know, they no longer have to tolerate this interference in their foreign affairs and such like.
You know, when you mention this meeting, and you know, we are also talking about the Free Iran Global Summit that's being held, could you maybe tell us a bit more about this and what exactly the agenda is?
They practically exist only through propaganda, especially since 2003 when they were disarmed and they could no longer sort of participate in their previous incarnation of a military force and try and attack Iran. So they've really taken on the mantle of being a propaganda outfit, and the sort of rallies which they held in Paris every year on the anniversary of their armed uprising, basically. So they've held this rally every year, various capitals, the Washington, London, Paris, of course, Cologne. They would have these meetings, these rallies, and get the invited guests in. So there's no change there. It is just more of the same. The difference now, of course, is they're in Albania. They have it's online because they can't meet, obviously, in person because of the COVID restrictions. But essentially, it is Mariam Rajavi self-publicising and getting together a whole group of anti-Iran speakers who will talk about perhaps a regime change or how President Ebrahim Raisi is a murderer and a criminal. And it's their way of actually staying alive, essentially.
The MEK, do they actually have any viable path to power? Because they claim to be in opposition to the Iranian government. They claim to propose an alternative. But what actually is it that they have to offer to the Iranian people? How do they market themselves as champions of human rights and democracy, given all of these things that they've done that you just mentioned as well?
Yeah, sure. So the Mujahideen, you know, they've sort of promised, let's say, regime change, but there's no indication from the Iranian people that they're actually kind of, you know, sitting there waiting for Mariam Rajavi to go and rescue them. And you know, the country's moved on in 40 years, and the Mujahideen, unfortunately, have really kind of lost the plot big time. Mujahideen have no support at all in Iran, let's say, even if people have heard of them, because, you know, many people have been born in the last 20 years who have never even heard of the Mujahideen. They're promoting sort of a regime change agenda which relies totally on the Americans attacking Iran. And you know, it's nothing, they will not actually, even the America has said, you know, we really don't want to involve them, we just want to use them. Now, the meeting, the rallies that's held this weekend, the focus of that, Mariam Rajavi has said, we must look at Ebrahim Raisi's record, events that took place 30 years ago at the end of the Iran-Iraq war. And that's the focus of her propaganda rally. The question that needs to be asked of Mariam Rajavi is, well, what about your human rights record? What about the war crimes you've committed against the Kurds, against the Shias in the south of Iraq back in the first Gulf War? What about the crimes against humanity that you've committed by killing so many civilians, your terrorist activities. But more than anything, people need to ask, how are you able to treat your followers as slaves? As I said, they were brought from Iraq without documentation. They're stateless people. They are not allowed to marry, form relationships. They cannot think for themselves. They have no choice about what they believe in. They have no life.
Anne Khodabande, thank you so much for your time, for coming on the program. Really grateful for your insight and analysis.
You're welcome. Thank you.
It is unequivocal that the group's history is a long and violent one. The MEK attempted several violent power grabs in the Islamic Republic, killing almost 100 officials. It assassinated Iran's president, Iran's prime minister, and chief of police, and then tried to assassinate another two of its presidents. It helped Saddam Hussein attack Iran. It helped Israel assassinate Iranian nuclear scientists and has received funding from Saudi Arabia and other foreign governments who have shown nothing but animosity towards the Iranian Islamic Republic. All in all, the combined terrorist activities of the MEK, in addition to their collaboration with Saddam Hussein in the Iran-Iraq war, have caused the death of around 17,000 Iranians. This shows that Iran has suffered some of the worst terrorist atrocities in modern history, carried out by groups that the United States and its allies openly support. So when we hear from former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo or other American officials and European officials who outrageously claim that Iran is a, quote, state sponsor of terrorism, ask yourself, who has supported the MEK after all its terrorist attacks and assassinations? Who has supported Israel in the targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists? Who armed and supported Saddam Hussein to attack Iran and assists other countries and parties in the region to do the same? Has Iran ever financed and trained violent groups inside the U.S. to overthrow the U.S. government or helped neighboring countries to fight wars against the U.S.? Certainly not. And yet the U.S. comes along and has the gall to accuse Iran of being a sponsor of terrorism. The hypocrisy is staggering. The United States and its allies do not care about instating supposed democracy in Iran. And even if they did, the MEK is hardly an appropriate choice. It's apparent that while the group claims that it aims to promote human rights and democracy, its activities and practices paint a completely different picture. It's evident that the group also lacks a real support base in Iran. It has no viable path to achieving its stated goals, nor does it seem to propose any concrete alternatives for the Iranian people to better their lives. The various backers of the MEK are aware that the group has no popular support in Iran and no path to power. For the Americans, the Saudis, and Israelis, the MEK is just a proxy tool that they can use to spite Tehran and attack Iran under the false pretense that it constitutes some sort of democratic opposition, despite its long and violent history. After all, the United States itself has a long and violent history of arming and training terrorist groups in pursuit of its foreign policy objectives, as we've seen in Latin America, Central America, more recently in Syria, and numerous other places. It's unsurprising that the West would delist this group as a terrorist organization and offer it cover and funding. They're not interested in what the MEK does or has done, so long as the MEK does their bidding and continues to attack and harass Iran, being a thorn in its side and sowing chaos in the country. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the All-Beneficent, the All-Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I'm Atta, the host of this program. This is Viewpoints. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, and we want to discuss another important topic regarding the speeches and the addresses of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. I'm Brother Ali Alavian. Assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaykum assalam. Thank you for having me here.
So today we want to talk about the important concept of adala, or justice, in the thoughts and the speeches of Ayatollah Khamenei. So regarding the concept of adala or justice, for sure, when we are on the way to achieve justice, there are some obstacles. And these obstacles ban us from reaching the justice in true sense of the word. The leader has also enumerated some of the obstacles that are on our way to reach justice, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. One of the things that the leader has talked about is that a person, if is not purified inside the spirit, his own spirit, cannot reach justice. So from one side in the world, in today's world, from one side we see that the people are getting away and away from purity inside, I mean tazkiya nafs, purification inside, and purification of the spirit. And from the other side, they are looking for justice. Okay, and a very big contrast and contradiction that exists. But according to what leader says, if a person does not achieve purification inside, for sure he cannot path the way of justice. Is it true?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, this is very true. Mm-hmm. Because you know the verse which we recited in the previous program, chapter 2, 124, mm-hmm. verse number 124, in which Allah said, "La yanalu ahd al-zalimin." We explained over there that if a person is evil doer, if a person is committing sin, if he himself is not purified, and if he's not going towards the purification, Allah is not giving the imama. Why? Because imamat is a status where a person who is just must get this, status. In regards to what you have just mentioned, that people themselves, they're not, purifying themselves, but from outside, they're seeking justice from outside. It is because we have two types of people. In relation to the ignorance, we have two types of people. One, the one who knows that I'm ignorant, and he goes towards the knowledge. He tries to get that knowledge. This person is aiming to get or gain the purification. This is a normal state. There is another type of people who even do not know that he does not know.
That's right.
He believes that what he knows is right. We all are ignorant towards our own, self, we can say, status. How many times remember Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? How many times we purify ourselves? The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, when he used to sit in a place, if it was even for 1 minute or 2 minutes, he wouldn't stand up from that place, or he wouldn't change his place where he was sitting until he at least would read astaghfar for 25 times.
Oh.
It's not for himself, in order to teach others.
That's right.
It means that you need to remember Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You need to purify yourself. And when we say astaghfar, or I seek forgiveness, it means that I will not commit this thing again. In the individual justice, when we were talking about the personal justice, we said that committing sin is injustice.
That's right.
And that's why we say, in the prayer we say, ظَلَمْتُ نَفْسِي.
Yeah.
I have done ظُلْم,
or oppression unjust, towards my
oppression
soul.
To my soul. That's what is this oppression? This is sin. This is wrong. We can say deeds. So basically,
but brother, believe me that in today's world, it's very much difficult.
No, it's not difficult. We are ignorant towards this. We do not pay attention towards this. It's not from our priorities.
I mean, the army of Satan is active too.
That was at the time of the Prophet as well. Okay. That was at the time of Adam alayhi salam. The Shaitan itself has made Adam alayhi salam to be expelled from the paradise.
But all these things, and the media and the amusements nowadays.
The main point is, what are our priorities? If we make our priorities, or if we design our life or routine life according to the priorities, which takes us towards the perfection, which takes us towards the purification, towards tazkiyatun nafs, yes, then these armies couldn't do anything.
That's
because, even in the Quran, it is also mentioned that even Shaitan in the Quran has said that I will take away or I will make them to deviate.
The human beings.
Illa salihin or salihun, except those who are the pious ones, who are the righteous ones.
Yes.
So we, every single person has the potential to become righteous.
That's right.
It's the matter, practically, do you gain that status or not?
And here comes to the scene the term, the mu'allim that you said, okay, or the murabbi, the trainer, the spiritual trainer, comes to the scene in order to guide the people. And you know, because the people and most of the families nowadays are concerned and are busy with the academic life of their children, they leave the spiritual part, okay? And this is spirituality for
this
sure.
This is the wrong definition of mu'allim,
yes.
Which has been, you know.
Yes, the academic, only limiting it to academic life and not the spiritual.
And one
life.
More thing I just want to add here, because you mentioned the academic.
Mm-hmm.
In today's world, we learn to earn.
Yes.
You know, that's our aim is this world.
Yes.
We do not learn to become perfect.
Money is honey.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Today, we get the education to have a good earning, good money, good status in this society, in this world.
Yes.
Whereas before, people used to learn for the hereafter. That's why we had the scholars who were the father of geometry.
Yes.
The father of medical sciences.
Yes.
I don't know, the father of algebra,
optics.
While they were the religious, you know, scholars.
Yes, they were Muslims, yes, faithful Muslims, that's right. Okay, Brother Ali Alavian, so Ma'naviya is one part of reaching justice in a society, and Sayyid elaborated on that, but Aghlaniya and rationality is another part.
Yeah, sure.
And I hope that we can say these two come hand in hand in reaching the justice. So when we are talking about the role of Aghlaniya or the rationality in observing and achieving justice, what do we mean exactly?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam and his immaculate progeny. Yes, the base for and this discussion, this topic from the very beginning that we started talking about justice, when we started in this series of shows to talk about justice, I think this is the peak of our discussion, where we are going to talk about the obstacles. What are the, let's say, this is sort of pathological look at the issue, that what is the problem that we cannot have a social justice in our societies. Earlier we have been saying that inshallah later on, that when we come to see the roots, the reasons or the factors that are working as the obstacle, we shall explain it. Now that the concepts are defined, alhamdulillah, the term and all whatever was needed was explained. Now is the time to see what are the problems that work as a, let's say, hindrance or obstacle. The first one that said explained was working on the self or self-purification. That is a key factor that we need. A person who wants to spread justice, he needs to first work with himself and make self-building with remembrance of God. With remembrance of God and practicing with himself, he can then prescribe the justice for others. But is that all? And that is spirituality by itself enough? To be honest, we have to say no. Spirituality by itself, or manawi by itself, is not enough. Spirituality accompanied by rationality actually will perfect each other. If this justice that we are after is having only one aspect of a spirituality, it will have a problem in the content then. So there is no wisdom behind it.
That's
but
right.
Also, in case the guy think it only rational, if the justice that we are looking for is something quite rational and without any spirituality, this is something that West is suffering from. So then again, it will come at the end of the day as the first opponent of itself, in performance, in the time that it's going to be implemented. So both of them at the same time are needed to perfect each other, to show a